Welcome to the Paris Hodges Podcast, a space for conversations rooted in curiosity of these divinely created bodies we've been given and this human experience as a whole. This is a space where we will explore all the complexity and nuance of existing on this spinning rock, while I share story and dialogue with some individuals I consider to be great investigators of our bodies, many of which have had profound impact on my journey and understandings. I'm grateful you are here. Let's dive in. Greetings and hallucinations, friends. Welcome to episode number 2 of the Paris Hodges podcast. Today's guest is my sweet friend, Candace Kennedy, who is a certified nutritionist and RCPC. Candace's journey began when she was diagnosed with PCOS at the age of 16. And in this conversation, you will hear more about what led up to that, how they diagnosed her, and then where that journey helped lead her down the line. Candace will also go into detail about her breast explant surgery and the amazing things that she's been experiencing in the post-op. Without further ado, here's Candace. It's so great to be here with you, Candace. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Paris. I feel so spoiled. I get to talk to you again after just talking to you a couple of weeks ago.
I know, it's amazing. I'm really excited to share both you and your journey with my listeners, as well as diving in a little bit more into what it is you do. And we met through the Root Cause Protocol and then have, you know, communicated lots through Instagram, which is always amazing.
Yes, I think I saw you give your health story and journey in one of our classes, and I was like, I have to track her down. I like, stalked you on Instagram a little since your class, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you want to go ahead and jump into it, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to where you are.
Sure, I'd love to. So I am a holistic nutritionist. I've been practicing nutrition for about 6 or 7 years now. And I just recently completed the RCP certification with you. So that's been, really, really exciting continuing education and such a valuable tool that we'll dive into more later in this conversation. But like many of us who end up working as nutritionists or in this space, I have a long health journey myself that started when I was really young and perhaps even before I was born in utero. But for the sake of time, I won't go through every stage of my life. But I'll just say that as a child, I was just really sickly, not any kind of like chronic devastating illness, but I was sick all the time. And I mean, I even missed 3 months of school in the third grade. I almost got held back in school a couple of years because I was out so often. I was always the overweight one. I wasn't, you know, obese or anything, but I was certainly chubby, and chubby enough to the point where I would hear comments from teachers and relatives and, you know, have girls in my class make comments that I was fat as young as like 8 or 9 and 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just became hyper aware that my body shape was not the norm back then, when most young girls at that time, this is in the 80s and early 90s, had much slimmer bodies, slimmer, more muscular, you know, like you would imagine a healthy young child to look like. So fast forward a few years to when I was 16, and I got my period, my first period, when I was about 13 or 14 years old. And then they just kind of stopped. So I went to an OB-GYN and was diagnosed with PCOS.
And young?
Yeah, really young. And what's interesting too is it wasn't all that common then. Like, I don't remember knowing anyone my age all throughout my teens and 20s. I don't remember meeting anyone else with PCOS. And now maybe it's just because it's the world I work in, but I feel like I know so many women with PCOS, and we can talk about that a little bit more that, you know, it is a growing problem. And it is a metabolic and endocrine issue that we largely didn't see up until a couple of decades ago. So, and of course, you know, if you're diagnosed with PCOS, what does a conventional doctor do? They immediately hand you birth control. Here, take this. This will balance your hormones. And what I know now is that I was actually shutting down all of my hormones and probably exacerbating the issues that I experienced later in life.
I think
that's really common even without PCOS. If a girl, a teenage girl or a woman goes in with hormonal imbalances, painful periods, it's like the one tool in the toolbox is, here is hormonal birth control.
Yeah. It's one of two different prescriptions given. It's either hysterectomy or like here's some birth control to balance.
Right. Balance. And without ever taking a step back to ask why those things are happening in the first place.
I'm really curious what diagnostic tools they utilized in order to come to that conclusion that you had PCOS at that age.
So the diagnostic tools used today, the kind of the gold standard is the Rotterdam criteria, which is you have to have at least two of the three. And one would be anovulation or just really irregular periods. So that's fewer than 10 periods a year, or your periods are spaced more than like 35 to 36 days apart. That's one. Two would be excessive production of androgens. So that is a really common symptom in a lot of women, but not every woman has this presentation. And when I was 16, I did not present with excess androgens. I presented with, I wasn't having a period. It kind of just disappeared. And then the third criteria where they did do a vaginal ultrasound and look at my ovaries. And I did have a number of cysts around, my ovaries at the time. So to be diagnosed with PCOS today, you would still use that criteria. Now, this was so long ago that I'm kind of like, I think that that is what happened. I do remember having the ultrasound and having pictures taken, and I know I wasn't having a period, but I don't know if that was strictly what they were going off of. I am surprised and happy that they were able to identify it so early on. Although I wasn't really given any tools to manage it, it was just a diagnosis and then be on your way kind of thing.
Yeah.
Just not empowering to us at all. Yeah. After that diagnosis, you know, I was just kind of going through my high school years and being really destructive with my health. Because weight is such an issue with PCOS, I was drastically under eating and developed some disordered eating of just kind of only eating 800 calories a day. And, that carried on into my early 20s. And, you know, not only was I not eating, but I was also drinking excessively, contributing more to that hormonal imbalance via estrogen.
Totally.
And then I just kind of started like getting worse and worse. And at one point I was on 5 different prescriptions and I was like, I'm only 23, 24, and I'm already having to be on these prescriptions. This is going to be the rest of my life. And this just doesn't seem right. And that's when I started doing my own research, which is kind of like a curse word these days. You know, we're not supposed to do our own research and look into our own health. But had I not, I would still be on those prescriptions. And you know, who knows how many others, because each one of those prescriptions had its side effect that was shutting down a different system in my body, depleting nutrients elsewhere. And thankfully, you know, over time I've been able to get off of all of those and find much more supportive and natural ways to support my hormone health. And that kind of brought me to the RCP a year ago, because I had made so much progress in my own health and have been working with clients for a while following the same principles. But I still had some kind of like nervous system activation that I just was like, this isn't making sense. And that's where the RCP has really come in handy, in both my own health and in my practice. So,
Amazing. How long were you on birth control then? Like, when did that finally cease?
So I was on and off of birth control for a long time, because I started at 16 and I did very poorly on birth control. It made me incredibly emotional. I just did not feel well on it. And so I kept going in and to my different doctors too. This isn't just like one bad apple. This is doctors all over Texas and in San Francisco, telling them like, I don't think this is how I'm supposed to feel. This is like, I'm miserable. And even kind of developed anxiety and depression pretty bad at some point, to which I was given antidepressants. I diverged, but I was on a lot of different types of birth control over the course of about 10 years. Mm-hmm. The last form of birth control, hormonal birth control, I tried was an IUD. Mm-hmm. It was Skyla. I don't think it's still available, but it was a smaller form of the Mirena. And when I had that, I gained 10 pounds that year, and I was like, get it out, get it out. And so that was over 10 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I identify so much with your story in general too, and like how much you're put on these prescription drugs and then given like more to like counteract what one is doing. And you're like, there's like this internal knowing where you're like, mm-hmm. this is wrong.
Yeah.
I want to get off of this hamster wheel. So that's really amazing. What was your path forward exactly in the nutrition world that really opened that door?
It was very iterative, because this has been a really long journey. And when I first started on my health journey, there wasn't this like plethora of information that there is available now that you can find on the internet. And I didn't really know about things like PubMed. And so in my like mid-20s, I found a site about some random site. I don't even think it exists anymore. But it just about nutrition support for PCOS. And it did talk about things like eating organic, avoiding toxins. They sold products that were like supportive herbs and had nutrition recommendations that I wouldn't necessarily like go along with now. But it was an eye-opening part of my journey, because I was like, oh, there's all these testimonials from people who are just making changes to their diet and nutrition and adding in a couple of herbs that are seeing so many changes. So then it just started down this path of like reading different books and just gathering different information and making small changes over time. I did do low carb for a really long time, and I thought that that was the holy grail for PCOS. Unfortunately,
were you still drinking at the time too? On top of. Mm-hmm. So this is the interesting part for me. Go on, but I want to.
I would love to hear what you have to say about that. But just to finish off about the low carb is just that it's a band-aid solution. You know, if you are someone who is experiencing insulin resistance along with your PCOS, which is a key driver of a lot of PCOS in women, insulin resistances. Then yes, of course, reducing your carbs is going to cause fewer blood sugar spikes, but then you're missing out on this really key nutrient that helps support the metabolism and thyroid function and cellular energy production. And you're naturally gravitating towards foods that are thyroid suppressive, like a lot of goitrogenic vegetables or excessive quantities of nuts and seeds. And so that really becomes just like a metabolism wrecking diet over extensive periods of time. So So I thankfully moved away from the low carb and find that women and myself who just really focus on getting the most nourishing foods and the most bioavailable forms, easy to digest, and following a more pro-metabolic kind of diet, but, you know, finding very sweet spot for carbohydrate intake, because I know some people who do pro-metabolic are like, you know, 300 grams of carbs per day and a lot or more. And a lot of women with PCOS, especially the ones who've been low carb for a really long time, are not going to tolerate that amount of carbohydrate intake. So
yeah,
I think it's important to find your sweet spot and not follow any kind of like dogma around this is what this diet says to do, therefore I must fit those macros.
Yeah, this is a part that I think is really missing largely in a lot of the conversations, at least that I come across. And I speak only from the place of my personal experience and starting to piece together like a lot of the puzzle pieces of my journey, that as an individual who also had an eating disorder and then was really abusive with alcohol for a long time. Well, I might not have said that I was necessarily low carb. I was totally on a like low carb diet, but I do think that there was an internal instinctual, like knowing, like asking for that alcohol to be able to have that sugar for the liver to be able to to try to convert in some sort of way, because there wasn't an intake of sugar really in any other sort of form.
That's so interesting. I could totally see that your body was just trying to compensate for it in some way. And then also probably the stress component, that like when you go really low carb, your body is really stressed out, and alcohol in the short term lowers your stress, in the long term increases it. But
yeah. So I think that we're not piecing that all together quite enough, that our hyper normalization of the two glasses of wine, like after work or at the end of the day, without really understanding more or less some of the potential damaging like harm to it. Because one thing that we know about the liver is if it's prioritizing, you know, detoxing this thing that it can read as a poison, like alcohol can be beneficial in to a certain extent in the body, but the body needs to be able to utilize that by not prioritizing the detox process first and foremost. And I think there's an overabuse of a lot of it in general too, that, you know, I do believe that if we paused long enough to really understand some of those cravings and like why we're having it and being able to replace it with whole food versions, that things would look a lot different.
100%. Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, on both fronts, one with, you know, I think that alcohol can have a place in moderate amounts in someone's a healthy life. I mean, we see in centenarians who have alcohol every day and have no presence of any chronic illness whatsoever. But I also stopped to pause of like, it's not the alcohol that is causing that. It's all the other factors of their life. You know, it's the community, the relationships, the sun, the activity, the low stress. And we just don't have that in Western culture. We don't have that in the States. Like, and so I think alcohol is often used as this crutch at the end of the day, getting home from work, you're really stressed out. Most women I work with are very undernourished. Mm. And so they come home and they have this intense craving for a glass of wine. And it's like, okay, I understand that you associate drinking this glass of wine with de-stressing, but let's really take a moment, like you just said, Paris, to like pause and see, where is this intense craving coming from? Mm-hmm. And you know, the relationship that you have, like, is alcohol a crutch and something you need, or is it something that you occasionally enjoy in a social setting, you know, with your loved ones?
Yeah. And you brought up a really good point too, that I wanted to add, is that not only are a lot of these women undernourished, they're undersupported too, is a big piece that we're really we've been conditioned to override our systems so much and get away from our cyclical nature that we're running on fumes.
Mm-hmm. So true. 100%. I mean, you yourself, you're a working mother, and you know, I'm sure like mothers these days just do not have the communal support that I think that we were intended as humans to have. You know, we weren't intended to raise children and families in isolation the way so many families and communities, especially in the US, are set up.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and then the pressure on women after giving birth to just like bounce back and get back to their size. And so it's just mothers are already in a very depleted state from the entire like building a human process to birthing that child, to feeding that child, to the stress of lack of support. And so they're so undernourished. And then they're told that like, oh, hey, you've got to lose all this weight immediately in this undernourished state. And it's no wonder that thyroid issues are so common after women have children, you know?
Completely, which is, you know, from my lens in the world that I work in, the thyroid is so connected to the use of our voice and how we allow ourselves to be energetically penetrated from the universe, or when we let people cross our boundaries and either speaking up or not speaking up. And then the suppression of our voice is so connected to mm-hmm. that thyroid function and then our ability to have that internal heat or fire in our body.
That's so interesting, but that makes so much sense.
Yeah.
I love the way that you put that.
So let's go into a little bit more about the PCOS part of it, and how you've been able to like support all of that.
Sure. I think that when it comes to PCOS, it's really misunderstood, and there isn't a lot of good information out there. And there's just a lot of like misinformation about what helps women with PCOS and what doesn't. And I think that it helps to start with what are some of the drivers behind PCOS? Because if you don't know what's contributing to this complex metabolic syndrome, like how do you even know where to begin addressing it? And throwing a lot of supplements at it and going low carb is not getting to the root cause. So one of the most common drivers I see is just chronic inflammation. And this often presents itself in women with PCOS with gut inflammation. Mm-hmm. So usually they just kind of go hand in hand, right? And it's in all of these scenarios, it's kind of like a chicken and egg story. Like there can be situations where women develop PCOS because they have some sort of gut inflammation that has been unaddressed for a really long period of time. Or they're developing gut issues because of PCOS and thyroid issues. But what we do know is that women with PCOS tend to have an imbalance of the microbiome. They tend to have an underproduction of beneficial short chain fatty acids throughout the digestive system, especially things like butyrate or butyric acid, which is the beneficial bacteria, or the, I'm sorry, the preferential bacteria that the colon likes to feed off of, these cells lining the colon. And furthermore, the hormonal imbalances that come along with PCOS and the stress that it causes on the body can also cause gut issues. So when the thyroid is suppressed, it's going to just like slow down digestion altogether. And that's going to give opportunity for opportunistic bacteria like SIBO and H. pylori and Candida a chance to start thriving. You're not clearing and moving food through your digestive tract fast enough. And that is where things really start to break down. So I think that it's important for women to first like look at what their digestion is doing. Did they have symptoms? Are they experiencing any kind of GI issues or non-GI issues like skin irritation and fatigue and brain fog that are often overlooked when they're overlooked symptoms of GI issues because they're not directly related to your digestion. So that was one of the first places. Another driver, of course, is insulin resistance, which we kind of touched on earlier today. Not all women with PCOS have insulin resistance, but it is really common. And that insulin resistance is one of the things that is causing the ovaries to produce more androgens. So a lot of women with insulin resistance and PCOS are going to present with more of the higher androgen symptoms, like excessive hair growth in places of the body where women wouldn't necessarily want their hair to grow, or losing hair, hair thinning on the head, kind of following like a male pattern baldness. Cystic acne would also be another symptom of higher androgens. And so that's another piece that, you know, you want to look at is how is your blood sugar? Are you keeping blood sugar balanced throughout the day? And how is your body responding to insulin? Do you have any questions?
Nope, not yet. Well, I keep wanting to piece together like the root cause protocol part of this all, because all I hear is like iron.
I know, it's so true. And that is what is so interesting when you start peeling back all of these layers, is that even though these are often seen as drivers of PCOS, they're still symptoms.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's still symptoms. And so you have to peel it back a layer even further of like, where are these symptoms originating? And that's going to be your mineral imbalances, iron dysregulation.
Yeah. Which is,
and it's so fascinating the way that it presents differently in everyone, you know, and this is just how it presents in women who develop PCOS.
Yeah. Which is really connected to that emotional side of it too, that like, you know, nutrition is such a like small percentage. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very important percentage, but when we understand the frequency of iron, which is that fear, where there's fear in the body, like that's where the iron pulls, because it's also the frequency of strength. And usually when we need excess strength in places, because we, you know, have that overload of fear, that it pulls. And then, you know, what I hear when you're talking about the digestion part is like, what is it that you're unable to digest in your life? Mm-hmm. Like, what is that thing that you're unable to like fully digest and be able to like allow to move through you?
Yeah, I love that. You know, I love that you bring into that kind of more energetic aspect of like, it's not just that iron is doing all of these functions or dysfunctions throughout the body. It also has this energy component of like, and I think that that's often missing from the conversation.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's an interesting part that's like missing from the conversation for me too, because it's like, it feels sometimes as though our desire to have these diagnoses are continuing to pull us further and further out of our body. Like, tell me exactly how many grams of carbs I need to eat a day, or how many grams of protein I need to eat a day, rather than like, what feels nourishing to my body? How can I tune in to what it is that my body's like actually asking for?
Totally. And that's the issue. One of the biggest issues I have with, conventional medicine is that it's so disempowering, because you have a cluster of symptoms and you're given a label to put on those symptoms. And then usually it's just like, and here is a pill for that, or, you know, or here is a surgery to remedy this. And it takes the power away from the individual, one, but it also two doesn't explain how that those symptoms came to be in the first place. And I think that is really missing piece of a lot of healthcare and approaches to health these days, is that it's just taking away from our own intuition and being able to listen to like what feels right and what doesn't feel right. Like when I was trying to heal from my PCOS in my early 20s, and for the first time taking that step back to ask like, wait a second, is this really right that I'm 23 and on 5 different prescriptions? And what am I supposed to just take these forever? You know?
Yeah.
That was kind of the first time where I really tapped into my own intuition to say, there has to be something, there has to be a better option. Mm. This isn't making sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. One of the things you just said about fear and iron, goes hand in hand with one of the main key drivers of PCOS is the third one, but it's HPA axis dysfunction and adrenal dysfunction and the impact that stress has on our body. And we know that stress and iron just love to drive each other up. And this is such an important piece of the puzzle. And I feel like even if women don't present initially with the symptoms of adrenal PCOS, it will eventually catch up to them because of the chronic inflammation that is caused by these mineral imbalances, these hormone imbalances, the gut inflammation, the insulin resistance, all of that is a stressor on your body. So it may not be the initial driver of PCOS, but eventually all of that's going to strain your body's stress response. And then over time, you're just going to have that more weak adrenal function and your HPA axis is just not going to be communicating effectively.
Yeah. Which I think is sometimes missed too from the HPA axis is that it's actually the HPAO axis.
An HPAOT, right?
Yeah.
Can't forget the thyroid either.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, you know, this is such an important piece for us to understand how our fertility is such a marker of our overall health and what's occurring inside of our body, because these things don't happen in a silo. Like right. Our adrenals are talking to our ovaries mm-hmm. all the time, and that, you know, the thyroid, and then we could probably throw an L in there as well for yeah. the liver being sure. like such a huge piece of that entire, like, how many letters is that?
Like, I know, the sixth letter. I know, we've got to come out with a way of writing that so we could say it as a word.
Yeah. To the overall, like, that is really such a marker for our overall health and wellness.
Absolutely. And I think that that is really missed a lot of times because, women are told, you know, you don't have to worry about that until you're ready to get pregnant. Oh, it's okay. Go on this birth control, you know, and then when you're ready to get pregnant, come talk to me. I had doctors tell me, like, you don't really have to worry about your PCOS until you're ready to get pregnant. And that's just flat out not true. And you're not ovulating, you're missing these like really integral parts of women's development and women's health and the production of progesterone, which is so supportive of your thyroid and your brain development. And, you know, I think about being on birth control for about 9 years before my brain was fully developed.
Oh my goodness.
You know, and I'm like, gosh, would I be so much smarter if I would have just had more progesterone?
It's so interesting. That's such an important piece that I think a lot of people are really missing too. I know I keep saying that, but I really think that there's a lot of pieces in this entire like story that putting an individual on something that actually is shutting down their hormone function before their brain is fully developed yeah. has lasting ramifications down the line. And this is when we get into informed consent. This isn't part of that conversation that ever occurs.
Never.
It is like these are going to impact you in X, Y, and Z way, which is yeah. one of my favorite statements to make is that minerals, you know, control our enzymes, enzymes control our hormones, and hormones control how we interact and perceive the world around us. And thus, like, in a little bit more of that spiritual sense, our frequency in which we're existing at, and thus even able to like call in or manifest or whatever sort of word it is that you want to use to describe how it is that you are attracting things in the world.
Yeah. I mean, 100%. And you even see and hear about how your preference for friends and your preference for mates changes yeah. when yeah. you're on birth control. You tend to want to gravitate toward someone as like you as possible when you're on hormonal birth control.
How interesting is that? Like, that part alone tells you so much as to like what is happening to our
perception. I know. Exactly. It's wild. And it is a really frustrating piece of that where I think that we, our generation, I don't know how old you are, but I'm 38. And so
I'll be 35 in a couple weeks.
Okay. Happy early birthday. So I feel like our generations were kind of like experimental because birth control was not that easily accessible for teenagers and generations prior. Yeah. And now we're seeing some of those ramifications of we were put on birth control at such an early age. And now all of these issues that were not so prevalent decades ago, like PCOS, endometriosis, dysmenorrhea, are becoming more and more problematic. And of course, you have so many other factors playing into that, not just birth control. You have xenoestrogens, you have environmental toxins, you have chronic stress is more intense all the time. Our food system needs a lot of help. We could go on and on, but I don't think that we can overlook the fact that women are having more issues with their reproductive systems and neurological health. And we were put on birth control and our hormonal system shut down at such early ages. And not to mention the iron that is in most hormonal birth control. Like Morley says, is like PCOS is just like chronic inflammation of the reproductive system on steroids. And it's just like, where is iron choosing to store itself? And then with already iron dysregulation in the reproductive system. But on top of that, you're given birth control, which is just throwing more fuel at the fire.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like we could have an entire like series of podcasts on birth control.
It's quite a in-depth conversation to really get into, especially when we start to look at this from the lens of you shared that you started your cycle at age 13 and 14, and then it disappeared, which is already indicative of a mineral deficiency, right? First and foremost, is if you have a cycle that starts too early or too late, like that's already saying there's an iron dysregulation occurring in an individual's body. And then it disappears. Then it's like, you were clearly showing signs of mineral deficiency and then went into even more mineral deficiency.
Right. Exactly. And, and then all the while being severely undernourished. And I think that that's a really common theme with women with PCOS, because another thing that they're told is to lose weight. And not all women, first of all, with PCOS are overweight. There's a lot of lean, active women. And in fact, a lot of many athletes end up developing PCOS because of the chronic stress of training combined with undernourishing. And I know that you personally experienced some of that in your health journey.
Yeah, I was diagnosed with endometriosis, which is really interesting because at the same time in hearing so much of like the PCOS diagnosis, I'm surprised I was never given that because at the same time, like I was showing lots of signs of, of PCOS too. So it's all very interesting how our bodies choose to manifest these, outward signs of like, hey, pay attention to me.
Yes, exactly.
Like there's a problem going on because I overrode my nervous system constantly. I mean, my adrenals have been taxed.
For sure. I know. Thank God for the adrenal cocktail.
Good one. It's
really,
good...
really brings you back to life. Yeah.
Which I'm curious too, as you've really integrated a lot more of these sort of these steps of the RCP, how you've seen your body change or be impacted by it all.
Well, so I've been following a lot of the RCP principles for about 18 months and incorporating them into my practice for about the same time. And it's also, of course, it's also iterative. You have the different phases, but I've also had an interesting year of excessive stress. I had surgery in October, which I'm happy to talk about. So I feel like it's hard to judge this past year by just the just implementing the RCP, since it was kind of an abnormal year. But I will say, my nervous system is so much more just calm. Mm-hmm. I have done a lot of other like personal growth work, a lot of things to just address that, that nervous system activation that I still struggle with, from time to time. But it is amazing. Like, I don't think a year ago I would have been able to like calmly had a conversation for an hour of a video without like starting to feel like signs of that activation. And you know, that's just one example. Or intense exercise, definitely not, which in general I don't think women with PCOS should do intense exercise, but that's another topic of conversation. The other thing is that my skin is so much like clearer than it's ever been. I don't burn. I'm very fair skinned. I'm very Scandinavian in my ethnic background. And I have always burnt in the sun. And just anecdotally, like since really focusing on getting more retinol and copper, bioavailable copper in my diet, the precursors to melanin.
Yeah.
I stopped like burning. And of course I practice safe sun exposure where I'm not going to spend 4 hours outside in the dead of heat of the day. But yeah, even just like being outside for a couple hours, I am totally fine. It has just been really interesting. Like I had already made a lot of growth in my own health journey, but just bringing in these principles just kind of like rounded everything out and made so much sense to me. And I still need to do more blood donations and things like that. I know I still have more work to do, but you definitely can like just feel the difference and the way your body responds to stress. And yeah. I think that's the foundation of it all, is like, how well is our body responding to chronic stress? And that's where the RCP really helps to strengthen that solid foundation. I mean, I would say in my practice, I find it, because women are coming to me in such depleted states, that I see such more intense results after 3 months than I did in my own health. And that's what's really exciting to me, is that's always step one, no matter what someone is coming to me for. Like I have several clients right now who have chronic gut issues, like candida or SIBO or overgrowth. And step one is not go in and attack and kill all of those guests. Step one is we go in and we strengthen the foundation. We balance minerals. We address iron overload. We get magnesium up. We get retinol and copper. We follow those steps of the RCP so that it lays the foundation to get women in a place of strength.
Yeah.
So that their body can handle and knows what to do with these invaders.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which usually end up working a lot of themselves out without the need to like go in and fight these things off, because a lot of these things do have a benefit when we understand the bigger picture of what's happening or why they're even showing up in general, because they're trying to help us maintain homeostasis. They're not there to like kill us in some type of way. Like our body's reacting to something else that's going on, in different ways.
Yeah. Like often stress or things like that. Yeah. And you know, most of those overgrowths like H. pylori and candida and even bacteria associated with SIBO, it's normal for them to be present in our body. What's not normal is when they start overgrowing and taking over everything. So yeah.
Which I think is a really important distinction, because immediately I feel like often people are like, kill, eliminate.
Get out of it.
Kill.
Yes. I completely agree. I know I used to be guilty of that. And you know, have done several working with a functional doctor, you know, back in 7 or 8 years ago when I had some gut issues, did several rounds of killing SIBO, but it always would come back. and, you know, it would go away. And I worked with a really amazing functional doctor at the time at a very well-known clinic in California. And the issue was they weren't addressing the root cause, mm-hmm. you know? I feel like I overuse that phrase all the time. You have to get to the root cause. And then it's the root cause protocol, but it's so true. Like I can't say it enough. Because there's a reason that SIBO proliferated in my body and doesn't proliferate in everybody else's, you know, like
completely.
There was a reason it developed, and that reason is mineral imbalances and dysregulation, chronic stress that leads to mineral imbalances. And that was never really addressed. And so that's one of the other reasons of like why that's always step one, is because like when you don't have your minerals in balance, it creates this environment where all of these pathogens just can thrive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's interesting too about what you said just a little bit ago when you were talking about the impact you've seen on your own body and the ability to have a far more regulated nervous system, which is what we see too when we start actually nourishing our bodies with more retinol, and our nervous systems are actually able to then exist in that parasympathetic state more often rather in that sympathetic like fight or flight or freeze like mode, that we're able to do things that at one point in time may have led to a lot more discomfort. And it's such an important piece to understand within the framework of all of this is the slow work mm-hmm. to unwind a lot of this, because I know for myself, I still want to be better like yesterday.
Yeah.
And so moving at this from a slower lens of being comfortable at a rate that isn't accelerated,
sure.
is really important to understand that it takes twice as long to undo the damage that we did.
I know. And that is one of the most frustrating that is a conversation I often have with clients, to just kind of set expectation. It's just like, this isn't going to unravel in a day, a week, a month. This takes time and consistency over time. And I think I shared a testimonial the other day from a client I had last summer. And this client has been really consistent, working really hard. And she sent me a note not too long ago and was just like, all of our hard work is really starting to come together. And, you know, this is like 6 to 8 months later, because she's been consistent, because she's been following through with this. And one of my friends messaged me back and she was like, wasn't that 6 months ago? And I was like, this is a marathon. It's not a sprint. You know, it took years for that client to get to the position that where she was so depleted and, you know, she still will have to continue working on her health and, you know, we'll still engage once every 3 months or so, to work together to do the next iteration, because
yeah.
it's just not linear. It's not like I'm going to start drinking an adrenal cocktail every day and every day I'm going to start feeling a little bit better. Like it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Which I think important too, in a body that has a menstrual cycle, that it takes 3 months for a follicle to mature. So we don't actually see the full impact of anything that we're doing today until like 3 months down the line. Exactly. So how we're actually like honoring ourselves and nourishing ourselves. Cause I think to shifting that understanding that what we're doing isn't just simply healing, it's a completely different way of life in yeah. general as well. Like how yeah. can I really nourish myself? How can I satiate myself? Mm-hmm. How can I honor myself to exist as functionally as possible?
Right. Exactly. That's so well put. Like it's an entire lifestyle shift. It's not just, I'm going to add this one supplement, or I'm going to start eating more raw butter to get retinol, and then my bases are covered. Like, it's moving away from like a lot of what has been so deeply ingrained in us by our culture, by modern living, of like having to have this fast paced life and having to fit this certain mold of what is acceptable for a woman to look like, you know, like being okay with like not being your skinniest self because you want to be your healthiest self instead, you know?
Yeah.
I think that it really does take not just like a nutritional shift, but a mentality shift to reprioritize like what really matters. What are like the true values behind wanting to feel better?
Yeah. Which too, I think you bring up a really good point about the being comfortable with the shifts that your body may have is in understanding how our body does already shift during our menstrual cycle too, on top of it, is like such a foundational piece that I think is really missing from the conversation. Because had that been something I had as a resource at any point in time in my like eating disorder life, it probably would have been, you know, easier to detach from like, oh my goodness, I just grew a centimeter like on my like leg or whatever it is that I was, you know, really attached to, because I could understand like, oh no, naturally in my follicular phase, I'm going to be like thinner during my ovulatory phase. I'm going to round out more because biologically that's when I want to attract a mate. And,
and then your luteal phase, you're going to be a little bit more retaining more nutrients and water because your body is preparing for pregnancy. It wants to create an environment of safety. Yeah. So you're holding on to more things. I mean, the concept that people, you know, are told to weigh themselves every day or even once a week with those fluctuations that women have in their weight throughout their cycle, it just, I think that is really, can be really damaging, especially with how prevalent eating disorders are and women not realizing that, you know, eating 1,000 to 1,200 calories a day is a form of undernourishing, you know, like that's an adequate amount of nutrition for a 2-year-old toddler, not for a woman, you know? Yeah.
Such important parts. I would love to dive into too. You touched on very briefly the surgery that you had back in October, which I've been privy to, but I know you feel like it's not something that you've had. Well, I'll let you tell the story.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so in October, as you know, I had my breast implants removed. I had had them since a week before my 18th birthday. So again, child making these very big decisions about my body and having a major surgery. And I had had them for a really long time, obviously. I had been talking for the past 5 years or so about having them replaced because I was like, well, they can't last forever. About that same functional nutritionist who I worked with about 7 years ago, she said she was the first person to ever suggest to me that my breast implants could have been causing issues for me. And I was kind of aware of the concept of breast implant illness at the time. And I just kind of, it wasn't a message I was ready to hear at all. I was like, nope, this is not a factor. It's something else. So fast forward to the past year, really. And I just kind of kept getting little like pings from the universe of like, it's time to have these taken out. And I was like, okay. So I was kind of leaning toward having them replaced with something smaller. And then one of my good friends, Natasha, who I absolutely adore, posted something on Instagram that was just kind of talking about all of the heavy metals and silicone and my implants were saline, but all implants, whether you have silicone or saline, all implants are in a silicone shell. And silicone is not this inert substance that we are taught or told. It secretes all kinds of chemicals and metals in your body consistently. So I saw her post something like about it, and I was so triggered by it. So triggered. And so like, she doesn't know what she's talking about. And of course she does. She's a very well-educated woman who works in health and wellness and does a ton of research. And, you know, it took me a week or two to step back and be like, why was I so triggered by that? And our triggers are some of our best teachers. And so I just was like, because she's right. And I don't want to accept the fact that she's right. So then another like ping was in our RCP course where there was a couple health testimonials about, you know, this woman, women with breast implants and then and finding true healing after getting them removed. So I joined this group on Facebook called like the Breast Implant Illness Group by Nicole or something like that. I'll send you a link to it. There's over like 200,000 members or something crazy like that. Probably more. I can't quite remember, but I just kind of joined to see, like, I want to just see what this is all about. And, you know, I honestly did not have the like plethora of symptoms associated with breast implant illness, which can range from anything to like anxiety and brain fog to like women with these horrible rashes, like covered in rashes, and they get their implants removed and bam, rashes are gone, you know, like, or one of the more classic examples is like women have like these red or yellow eyes, and from the day that they get their breast implants and they have them removed, and the next day their eyes are white again. I mean, that's, if that doesn't tell you that something is inflaming your body, I don't know what else does.
Yeah, no kidding.
So really what this came down to was like, I feel pretty great in my health already. I know that there will, you know, there may always be work to do because we're always going to be exposed to chronic stressors. And I know that historically I just have a really weak stress response, due to a variety of factors. So I ended up getting them removed in October. And yeah, I think there's been two noticeable things. One, I lost like about 4 pounds, and not all of that was boob, obviously. Like I didn't, it was probably about two pounds of implant and about 2 pounds of inflammation.
Wow.
And a lot of like, my face is just like kind of narrowed out, like my features, there's just been a decrease in inflammation in my face and my body as well. So lost inflammation, weight. And the other thing has been that I just like, my brain has been working a lot more fluidly and efficiently. Just, I have been a writer in all of my career for the most part. Even before I was a nutritionist, I worked at tech startups as a writer, as a content producer. And just the amount of content I'm able to produce now is just like,
I've noticed this. This is like, I'm always so impressed by your ability to create content.
Thank you. I feel like a machine. I'm just like, not kidding. Like it's hard to shut off sometimes. So that has been the other noticeable effect, but in truth, like it's all an experiment, you know. It's just like, I'm not ready to make any major proclamations, like good, bad, this was, you know, anything like that. I think anytime you have any foreign object, no matter what it is inside your body, it's going to cause some kind of low grade chronic inflammation. So it's something for people to be aware of, but it goes back to what you were saying earlier, Paris, about informed consent. And that's what this comes down to, is that when women go to get breast implants, they are not told about all of these issues that could develop. Of course, many women who have implants, probably, maybe they never develop them, they're not aware of them, or they don't connect the dots, or maybe there's many women who can be perfectly healthy. I don't know. But the important thing is knowing that this is, that it is, there is potential for these risks, and that these implants are not these inert substances that we've been told. They actually can secrete all kinds of things into your body and your system. I think that that awareness is really important before someone makes the decision to have implants.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's so important to understanding the connecting of the dots too.
Yeah.
I think is a piece that's often missing in our world of the connection.
For sure. And, you know, in our last conversation, we kind of talked about too, the other interesting piece that I am like, I am seeing kind of come together. It's just like the energy shift after having them removed of, I don't know. There's just like I don't yet have the words to describe it, but like, I do feel this energy shift happening in my body now that, and just in my emotions and my reactions, that I can't help but wonder if there's some sort of correlation to having that taken out.
Completely. What I think of too in this, what came up when you were sharing it was, you know, our breasts are they call them the antlers of our heart. And so our ability to actually like have that connection to our reproductive organs, because there's a line that runs from our heart to our cervix that even in like traditional Chinese medicine is a meridian you're not like allowed to touch, that mm-hmm. I really believe there's such a deep connection on that side of our, you know, both from a nervous system understanding, because mm-hmm. the finality point of our vagus nerve is through our cervix. And like, so when you really start to like piece this all together from mm-hmm. that ecosystem sort of understanding, I don't doubt there's such a huge connection both into your creative ability to like your energy of being able to like exist in the world in general. Like, it's really fascinating. Yeah.
I love the way you put that. That's so interesting. And it's just, those are just things I haven't thought about. And it's probably why I'm having a hard time articulating, like, I feel different. I know I do, but I can't really put the words to it. And just one more thought about the breast implant removal is that I have been able to notice changes in my body throughout my cycle that were not present to me or were not noticeable with the implants, and because they were so large, I couldn't notice the fluctuations throughout my cycle of like my breasts getting larger and softer during my luteal phase and as I prepare for menstruation. And just being able to see those changes in my own body that I haven't been able to see for over 20 years has made me so much more connected to my body and to my femininity, which is the irony of so much of this, because I place so much of like my femininity in like having large breasts for such a long time. Yeah. And now that I have them out, I feel more feminine and I feel so much more connected to that. Isn't that wild?
That's so good. That's such a good little nugget.
Yeah, it is. It's been a journey. So I'll keep you posted 6 to 12 months from now to see any more.
We'll definitely have to have like more conversations as to how that all unfolds, because I know in our last conversation too, we talked a bit about human design and that you're a projector also, and like the connection from the energetic body standpoint of understanding, like giving your body rest and really being able to, because that is a feminine energy, like that can sometimes feel really jarring on the system of individuals who don't want to acknowledge that we all have masculine, every single person has masculine and feminine energy, but that being able to rest in the stillness and nourish ourselves from that place of being able to slow down from that understanding, because projectors need rest.
I know that has been one of the hardest but best realizations that I have had in the past year of discovering human design. One, understanding more about why I always feel like I need more time to recharge than everyone around me, or I certainly like have several days where I can just be a machine and pump out content and do client calls, and then I just, if I continue down that path, I become less and less effective. Mm-hmm. If I pause and give myself time to rest and tap into my feminine energy, then I go back to being just as effective as I was before. But if I was just missing that part and then burning out so easily.
Yeah.
I think that's so important.
Yeah. Yeah. Such beautiful frameworks to work off of, building such a like sustainable, thriving life.
Yes, I know. It's just, I'm so thankful for you and for other people in this like kind of community of like alternative health. Where, you know, more and more the importance of not just like the nutritional side of things but the importance of tapping into all of these other tools that we have to understanding ourselves and how we perceive the world and how we interact with the world are like equally as important as what we're putting into our bodies. And, you know, the RCP also covers some of that. Like, it's an integral part of RCP is the energy and the EFT. I forgot what EFT stands for. Emotional freedom technique. There you go. emotional freedom technique. You know, these are all just all such valuable tools that I hope more and more people become aware of.
Yeah. So, and thank you for sharing all of it, because this is how more and more people become like aware of it all, is like through the sharing of our stories. So it's such a beautiful journey you've been on, Candace.
Thank you. Thank you for being a part of it. I'm so glad that we've been able to connect through RCP and that are continuing to grow that connection through conversations like this. So thank you so much.
Yeah. It's never ceases to amaze me how similar though, that thread that like really deeply connects so many of us, like through the conversation of eating disorders and, you know, all of the menstrual problems and how that relates to how we were foundationally like set up in this life.
It's so true. I know. It's just, finally piecing those puzzles together for so many people who like hear stories like yours and mine, and they're just like find little pieces and nuggets that they relate to too. And they're like, oh, hey, maybe that was, that did contribute to the chronic illness I'm experiencing now, because it's all so connected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So beautiful. Well, thank you so much for sharing, Candace.
Of course. This was so much fun. Thank you for having me.
And would you be so kind as to share, if anybody has interest in working with you, what's the best way to reach out to you and to do that?
Sure. I have a website that is CandaceKennedy.com, and that's Candace with two A's. Or I'm most active on Instagram, and my Instagram handle is Candace K Nutrition.
She's creating so much content. It's such good content too. It really is really impressive. I've noticed how much more you've been creating, and it's always like, I'm always like, man, it's just so good at this.
Oh, thank you. It was literally like 2 weeks after my surgery. I remember just like something like turned on, and it's been mostly, you know, other than giving myself time as a projector to rest, like it's been mostly like consistent. So that's been exciting.
So good. So good. Well, beautiful. Thank you so much, Candace.
Thank you, Paris. I'll talk to you soon.
And there you have it, friends. If you are interested in working further with Candace or discovering more about her work, her Instagram account and website have both been tagged below in the show notes. And until next time, I hope you always remember that you are created to thrive.